Aloha, you're listening to the Bungo Cast. I'm your host, Bungo Man. Currently, it is 37 degrees with a wind chill of 13. I'm joined today by the one-eyed alpaca. Alpaca, how are you?
I'm great. I'm cozy here with my Diet Coke.
Ooh, I'm drinking a Diet Coke, too. This is like my eighth one of the day.
I fortunately chose caffeine-free, though.
Ooh, where do you even find that?
For me, it's just right beside normal Diet Coke.
I rarely ever see caffeine-free Diet Coke at the grocery store. That's a rarity.
That is strange.
I wouldn't drink it, but
you could probably
I enjoy the caffeine. Probably. Alpaca, the reason I wanted to have you on today primarily is because I wanted to talk about fatherhood. So you are a father. I am recently a father.
Yes.
I have a 4-month-old daughter. You have 4 daughters. So how old are they?
We have the oldest is 11. Then we have a 9-year-old, 6-year-old, and a 3-year-old.
Wow. What's that like, having 4 daughters? Because I'm obviously with just one, it's already quite the handful. So I can only even barely imagine what it's like with 4.
It's a mixture between chaotic and smooth going and very enjoyable. In different measures.
Yeah. I'm finding that there is a lot of enjoyment in the parenting in subtle ways that, you know, I didn't really expect.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of leads me into the first real thing I wanted to talk about, being a father. And what's the most surprising part of it? Before you came a father, you know, 11 years ago, what did you not expect at all that you found to be true?
It may sound strange, but of course, with 4 of them, it's, you get to see the various different combinations of myself and my wife, all the different genetic variations that come forward.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense, you know, because I've got just the one,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so it's really easy to just kind of think that, like, oh, this is just how my kids, you know, in general would be. You know, and I know that's not true, though. I very much do not believe that, you know, people are blank slates, and that, you know, when you're born, you know, it's just entirely up to, you know, to your parents to impress themselves upon you. That, you know, it's like you said, you know, there's a genetic combination between you and your wife.
Yeah.
And it's, you're rolling the dice every single time.
And it's not even just like physical traits too; it's personality. And demeanor.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was kind of crazy to experience.
Yeah, yeah, because something my mom has told me, you know, because she spent a lot of time around our daughter helping us out,
mm-hmm.
while my wife and I work, is, you know, how she can tell at certain times, you know, the way she's acting is a lot like me, it's really interesting how it isn't just the physical traits, that it, you know, that there's so much of those things that about yourself that you kind of, you think you maybe have control over, you probably don't. They're really just deeply embedded in you.
Exactly. And even they do surprise in that aspect. And you're like, I didn't realize that was a quirk of me specifically. And now it's manifesting in my small child.
Yeah, yeah. What are some of those quirks that you've noticed in your kids?
I was just talking with my wife today about the way that I get angry at them. It's not something you notice and document at the time, because you're just full of the emotion. But I saw it when my oldest was scolding one of her sisters.
Interesting.
She was saying, no, 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 like, stop doing a certain action. And I heard it from another room, and I was like, that sounds like me, down to the number of times that she said no. Okay, I better watch myself.
Yeah. I'm still at the point where how my daughter looks, mm-hmm. Is really, you know, I think she looks kind of like a combination of my wife and then my maternal grandfather.
Hmm.
Kind of with my eye shape, but then the color of my wife's eyes, which is pretty interesting. I obviously don't know how I acted, you know, as a baby. So I don't really have any deep insight into, you know, her behavior, you know, where she's getting that from, which is why I brought up, you know, how my mother taking care of her, because she obviously raised me, so she would know there. What's the least surprising thing? What were you very prepared for?
A lot of it is a sort of disobedience. I was around kids when I was growing up in church. I never shied away from that. I never said I don't like kids or whatever. But it was the knowing that kids and humans even do not like following rules. They don't like following rules they don't like, especially. So we had come up, wife and I had come up with very specific disciplinary actions that we would do if and when they decided to disobey in various ways.
What were some of those disciplinary actions? I'm curious.
This is quite unpopular, but we SWAT.
Okay. My parents did too. Mm-hmm. To be clear, only when I was a physical danger to myself or someone else. I didn't really realize that until I was much older. But looking back, every single time that, you know, my dad, it was usually my dad, gave me a SWAT on the behind, it was because I was doing something that, if I continued to do it, would result in someone getting hurt.
Okay, so severity mattered.
Yes, yeah.
Ours is less that, and sort of the cardinal sin, I guess you could call it, is the fact that you are disobeying, and that's what gets the SWAT, the house. And of course, the putting somebody else in harm or continually disobeying gets even harsher punishments after that. And as they grow up and get older, they sort of become immune to the SWAT or even laugh it off sometimes. Then you got to get more creative.
What's the most creative you've had to get?
Sometimes it's if I'm thoughtful in the moment, if I'm not just caught up in my own emotion, I try to make it related to the problem that they caused. So if they're fighting over a toy, the toy goes away.
Mm-hmm.
But it's usually taking something away that they like, taking away a nice thing. And I tell them all the time, disobedient children do not get nice things. So it's maybe they don't go to a sleepover, or, you know, this is not new. It's not going to sleepover. It's the next time we go out to lunch, they don't get to eat the French fries type of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So are they at the age where they've kind of begun to internalize that and not just treat it sort of like a stimulus response thing, but begin to kind of understand like the reasoning there and, you know, the why behind that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm no expert on psychology or anything, but I contend that even as early as, say, around 2 years old, they can understand some of that.
Yeah.
Various different actions. And we don't usually surprise them. We don't just make up a rule on the spot that they break. They have to be told at least once that this action will lead to discipline. But early on, they know not to hit each other. They know not to... one of the earliest ones, like when they start crawling around, is cords, like electric cords. Phone chargers.
I'm fixing to deal with that pretty soon. I'm terrified because I've got a lot of work to do around the house.
And we never really baby-proofed the way that some people obsessively baby-proof and get everything out of the way and eliminate all the sharp corners and whatever. When they're crawling around, they're even cognizant enough to know we can label something and say, this is a cord. And then it takes them several tries, 10 or 12 or 20 times, to recognize that this thing is a cord. And if they touch it, they get their hand slapped. And kids thrive on boundaries. So setting that boundary, doing it in a loving way, yes, you're going to slap their hand and cause a little bit of pain, but it's a lesson that they need to learn that they're not supposed to play with cords or a garbage can. And the other part with discipline specifically is that it's come across that this is a benevolent dictatorship. So none of this is done for nefarious reasons, and we're not doing it just to be in control. It's because there is that much love in the house, and if they know that, or at least we tell them that we're doing this out of love for them, that we're doing this for their benefit, that helps a lot. And even saying that if I didn't love you, I would not be disciplining you. I would letting you do whatever you wanted and getting yourself hurt and getting yourself in trouble and hurting other people. That's what love doesn't look like.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. You can tell when parents don't, I don't want to say they don't love their kids or they don't care, but when they let their kids just do anything, you know, with no repercussions, with like you said, no boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
There's a real dereliction of duty there, I think, as a parent, and it definitely is not for the child's long-term benefit.
Yes.
You know, because if you're going to be, you know, a functional adult, there's just so many restrictions on your behavior that you need to have. And, you know, people have a tendency to think of that as like a bad thing, as being like inhibited. But if you're just going out there and like flailing your arms around and hitting people and just yelling, you know, obscenities at people or just taking people's stuff, you know, that's obviously not a good thing.
You won't get far.
You won't get far. Yeah, eventually you'll, you know, best case scenario, you'll end up in prison. Mm-hmm. Being taught, you know, especially at a young age, that, you know, like there's just some things you can't do, you know, if you want to, you know, live any kind of life that's worth living.
Exactly.
Is definitely incredibly important. I think it is really sad when parents don't enforce boundaries. I remember even thinking that as a child, you know, when you saw other kids who just behaved in ways that like would have gotten me in trouble,
mm-hmm.
and their parents just sat there and took it, and it's like, man, you shouldn't be behaving like that, you know, towards your parents. Is, I don't know, I like to think I was raised right, though.
Your parents did something right.
I think they did. You know, they were, I've thought, you know, a lot about this, about how I'll approach things like discipline and stuff. Cause like my dad, he didn't really have a good role model, you know, to base any of his parenting off of. His parents divorced when he was like 8 years old.
Oh.
I don't really know much about my grandparents' relationship before then, but you know, the guy that my grandmother remarried, you know, was apparently just abusive and absolutely not a father figure in any meaningful way. And so my dad, you know, spent, you know, his later childhood and teenage years, you know, just without any kind of like real fatherly discipline. And so he would often try and discipline me, and he would sometimes say, like, you know, I'm being arbitrary and harsh. And, you know, looking back on it now, I understand like that he kind of had an idea of like of what I was saying, of like there's just certain things that you just shouldn't do, you know, if you're going to be a successful adult. Mm-hmm. You know, broadly speaking. But I don't think he really kind of had any reasoned idea behind that. And, you know, I think part of that's just because he didn't really have that role model there. So I've thought a lot about like what he did to discipline me and why. And I think if it is just entirely like, oh, like you were saying, like making up a rule on the spot and then just being, you know, real harsh about that, you know, for no reason, that's definitely not a good thing. But having like a clear idea of why you're doing it, and then I think explaining it, you know, to an age appropriate degree, I don't know. Like I said, I've only got a 4 month old, so I'm, you know, I haven't had to deal with this, you know, but you know, when the time comes, that's at least how I'm initially going to approach it. We'll see. So far, she's been real easy to deal with, but we'll,
no disobedience.
There's no guarantee. There's no guarantees that's going to continue.
And we even started explaining the reasons why we're doing things very early, to the point where our oldest, when she started talking, she would use "that's why" as punctuation. So she'd end all of her sentences with "that's why."
That's pretty cute.
Again, it's not a new thing, but also treat your children not as, like, don't baby them down. treat them, talk to them as adults. It seems silly to even have to say that, but a lot of parents don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. I think even if your child isn't necessarily cognitively ready to fully understand things, if you're speaking at them, you know, at an adult level, I definitely think that it forces them to level up if you do.
Yes.
Because my dad definitely never dumbed himself down for me. I don't want to say he speaks to me exactly the same now as he did when I was like, you know, a 5-year-old, but it's not that much different. That forced me to begin trying to approach things in a more adult way early on.
Yeah. You might have to look a few words up after your conversation, but yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you homeschool your kids. What's that like? Because, you know, I went to public school. If I recall correctly, you did too.
Correct, yes.
So how do you homeschool your kids?
I personally don't do a lot of the structured homeschooling because I work full-time. My job is impossible to do remote. So a lot of that part is done by my wife because she only works part-time. My role in it is sort of explaining the world. Was it last night? Yeah, must have been. It's been dry weather around here. One of them walked up to me and touched my arm, and I got a little static shock. That was the 6-year-old. And I explained to her, I said, hey, do you want to learn how to do that again? Because she just thinks it's a random event, right? So there's impromptu lesson on static electricity and how to build up the charge and turn off the lights and watch a little zap from your finger to my skin. And so I think I even tweeted about it. So, of course, that led to all of them scuffing their feet around on the floor and zapping me every 6 seconds. So that's kind of my role is explaining some of the world and explaining how things work and maybe sit the oldest two down and talk about taxes or talk about why I have to pay the government $100 every year to drive on their roads or something like that. We live in Washington State, and for being a very, very Democrat-controlled state, a blue state, so to speak, the rules around homeschooling are quite loose. I don't remember all the specifics, but there's, for example, you have to test your students, your kids, once a year. But there's no requirement that you actually have to even look at the test results.
Huh. Interesting.
So that part is pretty loose. They have certain rules of, okay, you have to instruct in these specific subjects like history and math and literature. I don't remember all of them, for a certain number of hours. But literally nobody comes around to check. Nobody from the school system is going to come and check your notes and check to make sure you've done your tests or any of that. So there's none of that happening. So there's going to be some room for abuse for parents who just buck the whole thing and say, I'm not doing it and let their kid run free. But that does give us a lot of freedom.
Huh. So when it comes to the testing, like, how does your family handle that?
The testing is done, like, it's a standardized test. You have to do one of, I don't know, like 4 different standardized tests. So it's just like the Scantrons that we had when we were young.
Okay.
So you send it in and they give the paper test and the Scantron and whatever, and you have the kid fill it out and then send it back to their company, and then they send you results.
Do your kids usually do pretty good on it?
We just ordered our first one like 2 to 3 days ago, so I have no idea.
We'll find out.
Yeah, we will.
My next question about the homeschooling is just really probably the more interesting one, is why do you homeschool your kids? Because, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what I'm going to do in 4-5 years, whenever that time comes.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you for certain that my daughter is not going to be going to the local elementary school. That is absolutely not an option.
Right.
Which means, you know, either a private school or homeschooling. And the private schools, you know, are not close and really expensive and of questionable quality.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of, for me, leaves homeschool as probably the preferred option. But, you know, that's going to depend on a lot of things. So I'm curious as to what brought you to homeschooling your kids.
Of course, we started them out in private school. There was one that was actually close, and that was rather inexpensive. This scrappy little Christian school. We wanted it to be Christian. We're a Christian family. And it fit the bill pretty much perfectly for us. We sent them there. This is our first year homeschooling, so 11-year-old went there from all the way from preschool all the way through what, fifth grade. So it wasn't our first option. The first really reason why was to get them out of the public school. My wife and I actually met in high school. That's where we first encountered each other. So it's not that we are allergic, so to speak, to public schooling, but there are, especially nowadays, there are a lot of things that we don't want public school to be teaching our kids. There's a lot of things that can be hidden away from parents at a public school.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a big part of why my local school district is a fairly good one. But yeah, it's got the brain worms.
yes. And those are hard to get out.
Yeah.
So that's part of it. The other part is, this is less of a factor, but I kind of joke, halfway joking, you never see a school shooting at a homeschool.
Yeah.
And the other aspect is religious. The public school definitely teaches things that we do not teach as fact, and vice versa. If we were to be sending them to public school, we'd have to be taking them home every day and sort of unlearning some of the things that they learn from there. And that's almost homeschooling by itself.
Yeah, yeah. Having gone through public school and having, you know, learned a lot of things, you know, in public school, I have had to unlearn quite a bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly around history. You know, there's the way public schools have a tendency to frame things, around American history and around the history of the 20th century is definitely not what I will be teaching my kid.
Yes. Very different lens.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of ties in with, you know, all of the other, the rainbow flag stuff, you know, that it's all part of the same memeplex there. So you're in Washington, so this probably isn't as big of a concern for you, but, you know, for me, it's a major concern, and that's the demographics of the school district.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
If I were to send her to the elementary school that's in my neighborhood, she would probably be one of maybe a dozen or two out of several hundred students that speaks English as a first language.
Yes.
I can't in good conscience put my daughter through that. I feel very strongly about that. I do not think in any way that would be a good experience for her. And, you know, I have very little intention of teaching her another language other than Latin. Not that there's anything wrong with learning other languages. It's just, you know, I just kind of feel like she shouldn't have to just to get by at school. I don't think that's a great experience for anyone.
Right.
Like you were saying, you know, I would have to either unteach a lot of things that get taught or just hope and pray that, like me, by the time she reaches her 30s, she's kind of, you know, figured out, oh, a lot of that stuff was not right.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm able to raise her in a way to where she'll kind of understand the world in a way similar to me. But there's no guarantees there. And I think once you put a kid in, you know, the public school system, you're really relying on that environment being a good one.
Yeah, rolling the dice, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have very little faith in that,
mm-hmm.
You know, for a variety of reasons. I'll link in the show notes my thread on schooling. Have you ever read Deschooling Society by Ivan Illich?
I have not, no.
Okay, that's a good one.
I went to public school. I don't know how to read. Come on.
I had to learn in college. it's good. He was a Catholic priest, Ivan Illich was, and he kind of goes through some of the major, you know, flaws in schooling, not in education, you know, because I'm a big believer that education is, you know, kind of dovetailing back, you know, with, you know, the discipline, you know, because discipline is education,
yes.
You know, that education is an incredibly important part of being, you know, a functional, healthy adult. It's, you know, very culturally dependent, you know, like what education means, you know, being educated into your culture or whatever. Sort of the central thesis of his book is that public schooling acts as a ritual, which one, you know, you don't even know that it is a ritual. And two, it's an, you know, a 12-year long ritual, which makes it incredibly effective, that sort of indoctrinates you into modern society. And you're always going to be indoctrinated into something, you know, like you're indoctrinating your children into your Christian faith. And I absolutely do not mean that in any kind of punitive sense. Mm-hmm. I mean that in a entirely like value-free way, that's simply just it is that.
It's and definitional, yeah.
Because whenever you are teaching children about the world, and you know, whether it's, you know, the, you know, physics or metaphysics, that's what you're doing, and that's a good thing. You know, you wouldn't not want to do that. But the way that schooling works and the thing that it's indoctrinating you into is not healthy. You know, it's weird because like I did not hate school growing up. You know, I like obviously like I had moments where I was, you know, not a fan of it, but that, you know, like seventh grade wasn't too fun, you know, but it's not for anyone really. You know, but like high school was great. Actually, a lot of my objections to school have come, you know, much later as an adult when I've kind of realized, you know, like what was happening there. I think there's something about the way schooling is done in America, and I guess you could say the West in general, or just any modern country, is I don't think it prepares you to be a well-rounded, healthy adult. And the fact that anyone ends up that way is entirely in spite of schooling, you know, because part of the function of schooling is to make it so that way you believe it is a necessary thing. And if you've ever talked to someone who is a diehard defender of public schooling, they're more than likely also a diehard hater of homeschooling.
Yes.
You know, those things kind of go hand in hand, and it's because they believe truly that like this, that schooling is an absolute necessity. And without it, society would collapse. And I think in some ways that's actually kind of true, but it would collapse in a way that would not necessarily be a bad thing. But that's anyways, yeah. So that's how I feel about schooling and homeschooling. And we'll see. I hope in a few years I'll have the opportunity to homeschool my daughter and any other children I may have. But that's, you know, it depends on a lot of things that just can make it very difficult. So count yourself blessed to be in a position to homeschool all your kids.
Absolutely. Going back to the sort of logistics even behind it, it's when the way we're kind of approaching it is less book and less sit down and fill out the paperwork and whatnot.
Yeah.
And if you can have the kid interested, they're definitely going to learn more than if they're not interested.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big tie-ins to even criticism of public schooling is the reason why kids hate it is because they're not interested and they're not going to learn anything. So why are you even bothering?
Yeah. You don't usually get the why you know, for what you're learning in public school. You know, there's kind of the stereotypical, oh, why are we going to need this? You know, and I think properly educating someone includes explaining to them what problem is this solving, you know, because everything that you're learning, there is a reason behind it. You know, things like algebra and geometry, you know, those solve real world problems.
Right.
Without that, it's at best rote memorization, you know, which I'm not against memorization. I think there are some things that, you know, you simply, like your times table, like you simply have to memorize that. If you're, you know, recalculating 8x7 from first principles every single time you do it, you're gonna have a bad time. You know, you're not gonna ever really get good at any kind of math. But you need more than that, I think. And yeah, you don't tend to get that in public school. You know, there's usually very little hands-on kind of learning.
Yes.
You know, I'm a real big believer that people learn best by doing something, you know, badly and then being told, you know, okay, well, here's what you did wrong, and then doing it again slightly better and kind of getting that feedback loop. And when your classroom experience is just, you know, a disinterested adult, you know, at the front of the room lecturing you for 45, 50 minutes, you know, and then maybe you do, like, you know, some kind of exercise that involves, you know, writing things down on a sheet of paper.
Right.
You know, you're not really going through that kind of feedback loop that makes anything sink in, you know, because when you learn something, you should be feeling it in your bones, you know?
It needs to sink in, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's you know, literally you should be embodying it in some way. Mm-hmm. And school just doesn't really give you an opportunity to do that for many things. And I think that's probably one of my bigger complaints about it. And I think part of that is because, you know, you've got the classrooms, you know, full of, you know, 30 or more students. You know, I think the smallest class I ever had in high school was maybe 15 kids.
Yeah.
You know, and that was unusually small. And so you can't provide that kind of, like, one-on-one tutoring for a classroom of 40 students or
exactly,
whatever.
Yeah, it's impossible.
Whereas if you are homeschooling your kids, you do kind of have that opportunity to really sit down with them and provide that, you know, kind of feedback loop for them that I think is pretty important.
Yep. Yep. Talking about the experiential learning, one of the subjects that the state requires us to teach is occupational, and it's not defined on purpose, but some of that is we had to take a certain class to be certified as homeschool teachers. But the teacher of the class mentioned that includes just going to a business. And, like, for example, she used was a grocery store. Go to a grocery store, and usually the managers are happy to let a couple kids supervised in the back rooms see how produce is prepared, see how the bakery works, see how the shipping and receiving works. I mean, the kids are usually interested in that because that's something they go to all the time. They don't usually get to see the back end of things, and it's very much educational.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, because most adults even have absolutely no idea how any of that kind of stuff works.
Mm-hmm. And that's... We're talking about just the sort of real life. Normal public school doesn't let you do that. It doesn't teach you how a grocery store works, even though that most of us, I think nowadays, not very many of us, go to a grocery store on a regular basis. It's just part of life. But yeah, that's good knowledge to have.
Yeah. So switching gears completely here. Well, I guess not really, actually, since we're talking about occupational education here. You know, I don't want to dox you, you know, as far as, you know, what you do or where you work exactly. But I have it on good authority that you are forklift certified.
Ooh, the secret is out.
Yeah. So first off, what does that mean?
Okay, so I can dox slightly. I work in a manufacturing facility in in the United States of America. They're rare nowadays. I am on the factory floor as a worker. I'm not like in an office or anything. And yes, I am forklift certified. What that means is, at least, and it's not really, I've discovered, is like an OSHA term. It's not something that's nationally defined or anything like that. But there is a training course you go through and watch a cheesy video. Then you answer some questions that anybody with anybody that's smart enough to get hired at a job can fill. Can pass these tests. And then it requires getting on the forklift and having some practice and having some supervised time moving around. There's a certain probationary time frame where I was using it and doing normal activities with it with somebody watching me, spotting me. And then after a certain amount of time, I get tested by the instructor again, perform certain tasks and answer questions, and then I get my fancy little card that says I'm certified.
So would that transfer to another employer, or is this just at your current employer? And if you were to move somewhere else, you'd have to get recertified?
Yes, it would be. It's employer only. I can't go to Costco and just hop on one of their forklifts or something like that. Although having that, I mean, I've been doing it for 7 years now. If I were to say go to Costco and put that on my resume that, hey, I've been driving a forklift for 7 years, that's definitely something that they see approvingly, that I have that experience and I've never crashed one or anything. But they would have to recertify me.
You haven't crashed one?
I have not.
Okay, I have a feeling I would crash one pretty quickly.
Those things are heavy.
Oh, I bet.
No property damage. I've had a couple bumps here and there and misjudging things, but nothing recordable.
Do you own any of those ridiculous "my wife loves me because I'm forklift certified" t-shirts?
Oh, no, those are cheesy as all get out. No way.
All right, I'll be sure to mail you one. In it.
Okay, if you do, I'll take a picture of it.
And then put it in the drawer and never wear it again.
No, but it is something. I sort of play it down, but not everybody can drive a forklift. There are some people that I work with who are deathly afraid of getting trained. They're like, no, I don't want to do that.
Really?
Yeah.
I would imagine that would be like a coveted thing, you know, because it's like heavy machinery.
It's,
you know,
fun.
Like you were saying, and that's, you know, like, who doesn't want to, you know, drive heavy machinery? I mean, I wish my job involved that.
And there are some people who are just bad at the coordination of where the forks are.
Yeah.
There was an incident a few months ago where somebody didn't judge where their forks were, and all this, it caused a big problem. So yeah, it isn't really for everybody.
Would you say you have to be at least a little bit of a shape rotator to drive a forklift?
Absolutely. It's literally rotating shapes around.
Yeah, I could see it. You need to like be able to lift the pallet up with your mind.
With your
mind. Before you lift it up with the fork, you know, you have to envision how all that's going to work.
Yeah, and I do spend, when I'm moving things around and getting it in the right spot, I do, it looks like I'm just staring off into nothing, but I am sort of envisioning where things are going before I move things around. I'd say that's an important part of it.
So you built a trebuchet at Vibe Camp 3.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that? You know, how did you do that? How did you come up with the design? What did you learn from that? I've got a lot of questions about that.
So, yes, I was the trebuchet guy. I don't know if I would, am I too humble in this, but I wouldn't say I built it.
One ever builds a trebuchet by themselves.
That's true. You know. Well, not that one, not one that big, but it started really, kind of with you. We're at Vibe Camp 2. There's a, whoever's been there knows about it. There's a big swing set. It's like 6 or 8 porch swings, all attached in this wooden structure where people can sit in these porch swings and be facing each other. And it's kind of a conversation gathering spot. And it's really cool and big and made out of wood. And that was really fun. And then I discovered that it wasn't built by the camp people themselves, the people that own the campground. It was built by previous attendees, people who had stayed at that camp for their whatever event. And that sort of structure is encouraged by the campground. So that kind of got my thoughts flowing, so to speak. And I think I even joked to you on the bus ride back that our project should be a trebuchet. Because it kind of ticks all of those we like the medieval siege weaponry, and we like a big project, yeah. And we like something that can cause destruction, and it was kind of perfect for that. And that was sort of it. That was, June of 23. And nothing really happened after that. There was jokes, and it would come up every month or two or something. And then what really got things going forward was that organizers said that there was going to be there was grant money available to projects. And I said, okay, if we're not paying for this out of our own pocket, how could...
Did you get USAID money for this?
Thanks, Trump. watch out, we're going to get doged. And it turns out this sort of project is exactly what the organizers were wanting for where they wanted their grant money to go. So as soon as they announced it, I said, okay, we have to do this. Joke about the outcomes that you want. So I applied to it. I sort of really quickly planned how much it might cost and what kind of materials and people would be needed. And they approved it without really any question, which I was a little surprised at. But we had a budget of, I think, $800 or $700, which to me was a gigantic amount, but we actually made just under that budget. As soon as I got that sort of secured, I put out sort of a broadcast saying, okay, who's going to Fide Chem 3 and who wants to help me build a trebuchet? And there was immediate response. As with any of these types of projects, it's hard, really, I found. It's not like a work project, like my boss hands me something that I need to do and I get the people and the resources and then we do it. We're doing that because we're there to get paid, and that's what we're expected to. Sort of wrangling the cats in this situation, getting all these people who are volunteers who are doing this on their own time was kind of challenging. Because there were about, I don't know, a dozen people to start with who wanted to do this. And in the very end, there was only 5 people who were just kind of from the beginning to the end people, not including myself, that stuck around. So anyway, put out that broadcast to say, okay, who wants to build a trebuchet at the Vibe Camp? At that point, I'm not an engineer, even though I'm kind of engineer-minded. I don't have really any experience with woodworking or how to plan all of the angles and what the payload is and the counterweight and all that. So I was very fortunate to have people who volunteered that wanted to do this happen to be the ones that are good at that sort of thing. We had one guy who has lots of experience with woodworking and carpentry. We had a few people who are design oriented. So it just so happened, turned out, that I got a great team of experts without really too much overlap to work on it. We scheduled I did a lot of the logistics and scheduling and planning and that part, that type of thing. We had some Discord group chats going. I think we did about 4 of those to plan sort of the scope and what we wanted to do and how we wanted to design it, what we wanted to throw with the thing, cantaloupes. and it really kind of flowed from there. That's how it started.
So what would you say was the biggest thing you learned from that?
Well, the whole experience is... The most valuable thing I learned was sort of dealing with with the organizers of Vibe Camp, keeping them in the loop, making sure the paperwork and the documentation for getting the funding and all of that was in line. Having had no real project management experience myself, I was a little too fast and loose with that. So making sure that they got the things that they needed so I could get reimbursed properly was my biggest lesson.
Did you run into any structural problems with the trebuchet? Because trebuchets, they can be finicky.
Yes, we did have a few problems. It actually, the base structure turned out great. It was well designed. The experience guy who had the experience with woodworking and everything, that was very valuable, that had the right sort of attachment points and hardware to use to build it. The first problem came when we were test firing it.
What did you use? Just like a pipe or something?
Yeah, we just used a metal plumbing pipe. We're like, oh yeah, that's strong enough. What could bend that? Well, it turns out a lot of force could bend that. So that was on the Saturday of like the final full day of Vibe Camp, is we had the presentation and it bent. So we had to sort of organize a really quick trip into the Home Depot to get a stronger pipe, a thicker one. And it had damaged a little bit of the structure part too, so we had to get that reinforced. And we probably a little over-engineered the repair because we didn't want it failing again on the next day. But work on that continued well into the night. They had headlamps going on and everything, so that was fun and a little bit stressful at the same time.
So how far did you end up throwing a cantaloupe?
I don't think we measured. A lot of our testing was done with a medicine ball. A 5-pound medicine ball, because cantaloupes are obviously limited in quantity, even though they did give us like 30 cantaloupes, which is pretty cool.
Did you fire all 30 cantaloupes?
Depends on your definition of firing them. So we had some tests with the medicine ball that went really well, and then a few shots with cantaloupes. And on the final day on Sunday, the netting. We didn't really plan for the net that holds the cantaloupe. We didn't make a really good plan for that, and all we had was just a piece of leather. And we didn't reinforce the attachment points on the leather, so there was rope attaching it to the trebuchet end. So it just kept ripping holes in it. So we had to sort of give up on that. So we fired probably about half a dozen cantaloupes and out of the trebuchet, and the rest were just hucked into the pond by people.
So they all went flying.
Yes, they were fired
not
by
necessarily
people
from the trebuchet.
Exactly.
I wish I had been there for that. I can't remember why I wasn't able to go. We are a little bit past an hour.
Okay.
So I think now is a good time to maybe start wrapping this up. Alpaca, thank you so much.
Of course, Bongo.
For coming on today. This was great. And you will be back. You may end up being a recurring guest.
Is that a threat?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, because I'm pretty certain not very many people are going to want to come on this.
And at least a dozen people listen.